Good morning and welcome to Manzanita Voices. This is Linda Field. I'm your host. I'm really glad you've joined us today. I hope you had a great week and that you're getting yourself comfortable. Pour that cup of coffee and find a comfortable chair and just settle in for a good hour of conversation with someone who's really creative. I have a wonderful guest for you today, and I think you're going to like hearing what she has to say about a project that she and her husband has completed, and you're going to be able to see it on television this month, September 2012. So pour that coffee, and here is my guest, Sally Kaplan. Hello, Sally. It's nice to have you with me.
Hi, Linda. I'm thrilled to be here with you, too.
Now, Sally and I know each other because Sally's been coming to our Writers Unlimited meetings when she's not running all over the country because of this documentary that she and her husband, David Vassar, have produced, written, directed, and produced. Tell me, who had which jobs in this project, Sally?
Well, it does overlap at times, but our full titles are I Am the Producer, and David is the writer, director, and co-producer. And those are our titles on paper, and as we get into the conversation, I'll let you know how some of that overlaps, however.
I bet it does, especially since you're married. And so the name of the film, it's a documentary. It's in two parts. It's going to be shown nationwide on PBS in September. At different days and times, of course, around the country. It's called California Forever, and I've seen it. It's just a beautiful film. Thank you for making it.
Thank you very much. I think California Forever, the title itself, actually, David came up with that great title, implies what I hope the film does as well. If these places were set aside years ago by individuals like ourselves, individuals like ourselves might choose to set aside new ones, but they are meant to be here and preserved forever.
Forever. Not just for the people who can enjoy them now,
right,
and who might exploit them. Yeah. You were telling me about a great statement that Wallace Stegner made about the beautiful places in nature. And of course, when you think of beauty in California, you think of Yosemite. You think of all the Sierra Nevada mountains. You think of the coastline, Big Sur, so many wonderful places. And Wallace Stegner, you pointed out to me, made a statement about these places need to exist for everyone, even if they never get to go there. They just need to know in their heart and in their mind that those places are there, that they exist. Otherwise, think what it would be like. It would be very hard to maintain your sanity, I believe.
I think that's really true. I think when Wallace Stegner made his comment, he wasn't talking specifically about the beauty in California. He was talking about more the need for nature in the human psyche. Oh. I think he even went on to say that there are more people who drive up to the edge of a place like the rim of Grand Canyon to look in versus going down in it. But it doesn't matter. They're the ones that are going to drive up and look in. They're the ones that never get 50 feet from their car. And there are those who just look at it in pretty pictures and never go. It really doesn't matter. These places are like a piece of our collective soul. I'm making that up as I go.
That's exactly the word I was going to use, our collective soul.
Our collective soul. And one of the things interesting about working on this project, California Forever, is these California state parks are not just pretty places, I discovered. Many of them are. The iconic ones are beautiful. But they're also historic sites that have been preserved. They're also cultural heritage sites that have been preserved. They speak to, I'll use the word again, collective memory of what it is to be Californian.
Okay. And maybe even collective memory of what it is to be human.
I think that's a good point, because California, to a lot of people, is a mythological place. It's a place of the mind. Kevin Starr, the historian, who used to be the historian, the librarian of California, features prominently as an interviewee and carries a lot of the story of especially episode one. And he speaks about California as a piece of the human imagination. He talks about California as a place Europeans want to come, and many people from afar want to come. California as an idea.
Well, I grew up in New York State, and even just watching Hopalong Cassidy movies in the movie theater when I was a kid, before television, I saw the landscape where Hoppy rode his horse, Champion, and the cliffs, and of course it was all in black and white, so I didn't see the colors, but I was still captivated by the magic of the landscape, and it's partly what made me want to come to California.
I have to say, I too am from the East Coast originally, and I too, it wasn't Hopalong Cassidy so much, it was just the images and the words I always heard about California, this great vast place, all the way from Disneyland to the tippy top, North Coast Redwoods. And when I first came to California as a child, I'll never forget, I was 13 years old, and my sister and my younger brother and I took a trip with our mom, and she introduced us to California. And it's almost embarrassing to admit this, but she had a phobia driving along the coast, so she actually paid for a taxi to drive us from San Francisco down to Pebble Beach so that she didn't have to be afraid of the cliffs.
Along Highway 1. Oh my goodness, that's funny. I remember I drove my mother along Highway 1 and my mother was terrified. Yeah, because we were going south, so of course we were on the outside closest to the cliff. And I was wanting her to enjoy the beauty, and she was just hanging onto that door handle.
So the humorous part of that memory does stand out to me. But the other thing that stood out to me growing up in the East Coast is how much of the California coast is visible from a car. I mean, when you go to the East Coast and you drive, you have to go to pretty far away places, or you have to go to very urban, crowded places to see the coast. But here, there's this massive piece of Route 1 that you're just driving and driving, and you're like outlining the coastline in your imagination as you go.
Yeah.
And not until I worked on this project beginning 4 years ago did I really get, okay, these places exist because they were preserved as state parks.
And thank heaven for that. And that's the truth. Yes. Just imagine if Big Sur and Highway 1 was all privately owned and no one could drive there. It would be a totally different state. Now, Sally, tell me, what is the structure of the documentary of California Forever?
So California Forever, as it stands now, is a two-part PBS special. Each show is a PBS hour, which literally is about 52 minutes long. The first one is the arching history of California State Parks as a system. It pinpoints the places that represent turning points in the history of these places that became our California State Parks as we know them today. The structure and the style of that film is very much like what audience members might know if you were to watch a History Channel show. It's historic. We have reenactments with actors playing out some of the parts. We don't do a survey of every single park. It's not a tidbit or a trivia story on parks at all. It delves rather deeply into the sweeping history of these California state parks. The second hour is much more on contemporary issues that parks are facing today. Issues such as the competing claims of animals versus people who want to use the same park. We have a story about the elephant seal in contrast to the western snowy plover, and how people love to come to these very same beaches and go swimming and take walks along the beach, but are sometimes met by mammoth animal they didn't intend to run across, or they see a sign that says "Do not walk here" and an exclosure that keeps them out, and they look closer and they see that this is preserving a tiny little bird that is about to go extinct, so that it can lay its eggs and not abandon them when they see a person come near. That's one challenge. I can go into more.
Yeah, you know, I remember. Years ago, back in the 60s, I lived in Santa Cruz for a while, and I went to Año Nuevo State Beach and didn't know what it was all about. I just saw the sign and turned in and parked and went walking on the beach, and I saw this huge rock, and all of a sudden, the rock got up and moved, and it kind of flumped along the sand toward me. It was my first elephant seal. It was amazing. Now you go there, and you're totally restricted, which is good for the animals. But you don't have the freedom that I'm so glad I had to walk among those seals.
Well, actually, it's interesting that you point out it was the 60s, because I believe the population has, I don't want to get my facts incorrect, I'll have to fact check this, but has like tripled since then. And part of the reason why there are more restrictions made is because management is afraid that there might be some interaction between people and these animals that could harm people without realizing it. There are places that you can still go that are not as restricted, where you can get up close and personal with these animals, but you have to go on a tour so that for your own safety. Yes.
Sure. Well, that's understandable. Sally, I can't believe it. Our first part is over. Everybody stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. This is Linda Field, and we're talking today with Sally Kaplan about her documentary that is going to be aired on PBS this month, and it is called California Forever. Sally, this is not your first documentary, I don't think. So what did you do before this, and what path have you followed to get here?
That's a good question. I am not one that has taken very straight paths in my life. I actually, in my 20s, I was involved in experimental theater and dance in New York City.
Ooh.
And then I realized that I was not getting the parts I wanted. I was not getting the recognition I wanted. The company I was working with at the time, Meredith Monk and her ensemble, were no longer needing actors, dancers such as myself. They were moving more in the direction of musicians. And I wanted to use more of what I had to offer as both a writer and an idea person. And someone grilled me. It was an older woman. I don't think of it as older now because I'm older than she at the time. But in my 20s, she seemed like an older woman. She was like in her 40s. She was ancient to a 20-year-old. She was a mentor of mine. She was someone who ran a writer's group I was a part of. And she just interviewed me, and she asked me, "What do you really want?" And I heard myself say, "I want to be a filmmaker. I want to work in film." And she said, "Well, what's the first thing you would do to get involved in that?" And I said, "I guess I'd have to learn somehow." So I signed on with a documentary social issue production company that was convenient. It was down the street from where I lived in New York City. I could not afford their courses, so they invited me to work in their office in exchange for their courses, and that's how I entered the documentary world. And I was in my late 20s at the time. Since then, I've done a range of things related to film and television, often as a writer for shows like HGTV, Weekend Warrior, and a lot of Food Network shows as a freelancer, and often as a producer, shows like Travel Channel type shows.
I didn't know all that about you, Sally.
Yes, so I have, and I've always dabbled in writing fiction on the side, never published any fiction. I've published some of my nonfiction works in various publications. But I was the through line was always film and television. And when David and I met, David had been working as a director for 14 seasons on, at the time, a hit show that many of you have heard of called Unsolved Mysteries.
Oh, yes. Oh, wow.
And he was able to put his two lovely daughters through private school in Los Angeles on that job. He traveled the world. He did a lot of interesting shows. And he freelanced in other areas as well. And he was the one that started this company that we partner in together now called Backcountry Pictures. He's always been, environmentalist is such an overused word, but a nature lover in his heart and soul. He was a ranger in Yosemite in his early 20s.
Oh, my.
And his dream was always to do something that involves nature and film. And together, when we started the company, he had already made the signature film that still to this day lives in the visitor center at Yosemite. It's called Spirit of Yosemite.
I've seen that film. He made it?
That's David's film.
Oh, my goodness. This is like old homeboys here. That's wonderful.
And together, we decided to form our own company, and we saw the landscape of our industry shifting. We saw that when cable television came in, the pieces of the pie were sliced into thinner and thinner slices. Mm-hmm. And seasoned professionals like ourselves had less and less room to be involved at the level that we wanted to be. We would be showrunners and executive producers, perhaps. But there were. It turned out that there were more and more 22-year-olds interviewing us for jobs they were scared to give us because they knew we were more trained than they. And we saw, as David puts it, the writing on the wall, that the best way to do the kind of work we really wanted to do was to be to form our own company. So together we formed Backcountry Pictures, and we decided to make it a quote-unquote niche company, a company that would focus on issues of the outdoors, environmental nature, and nature, no pun intended. And the first work we did together as a company was on, it was called Restore Hetch Hetchy, and it was a campaign that was being run at the time by Environmental Defense Fund. And they wanted us to create an advocacy piece, which is very different than a PBS piece. Because in PBS, you're trying to be as balanced as possible. Mm-hmm. They outright wanted an advocacy piece for the restoration of Hetch Hetchy. We were fortunate enough, after the first cut of that film, they managed to pull in Harrison Ford to narrate it. And we invited Harrison up to Hetch Hetchy to do a cold open, which is an in-person, on-camera open, and we all had a blast. And then for a while that film went away because the politics at the time did not want the restoration of Hetch Hetchy. And
what year was this, approximately?
This was 2007.
Oh,
and,
okay.
And I'm sure some of you have heard that it's back in the news.
Yes, it is. I'm so glad.
Yeah, this is one of those things that we've discovered with California State Parks as well. You know, the pendulum shifts one direction or the other. There are different people who push forward whether or not the arguments for or against certain issues. And it's constantly changing. And I am old enough now to realize that nothing is set in stone, and how important it is to work on what you're passionate about.
And, you know, when you say nothing is set in stone, that kind of gives me a little chill in my spine, too, because today we have Yosemite, we have Yellowstone, we have the other beautiful parks that have been set aside, and we need to set more places aside. But just because those parks exist as they do now does not mean that 100 years from now they will be here. They have to be defended tooth and nail every year for eternity, for as long as mankind is on Earth.
Well, Linda, actually, you're saying it better than I could. I mean, sometimes people ask us, why did we make this film, or what do we want people to walk away with? And I think if I could quote Linda, what you just said per verbatim, that's exactly it, that we all take for granted that these places will be as they exist now forever, and they won't necessarily, especially with more and more people coming to California and less open space available. I mean, David showed me an article in the newspaper a few weeks ago that was rather impressive and upsetting to me, that in Ohio they are talking about drilling oil on a state park. So no, these places are not necessarily defendable and there forever without our help.
Right, and what about the fracking issue? Yeah, or is that what you're referring to? They want to do fracking in the parks.
In the parks.
In the parks.
I mean, when people created these parks 150 years ago, they did not intend generations to come to use them to rape the land, supposedly, for the natural resources. That was not their original intention. We owe it to them to honor what their original intention was.
That's right, and we owe it to our progeny, the people coming after us, to preserve these places because, as I said earlier, I don't think humans can maintain their sanity if they don't at least know that these beautiful places are there. They may not go to Alaska to see a polar bear. They may not ever go to Africa to see a real elephant in the wild. But if they can know in their mind and their heart that they're there, something, I know in me, something inside me quiets down and becomes peaceful because I know that this perfection and this beauty and this magic is out there somewhere.
I think your point is very eloquent. I think it is important, however, to have at least one experience of the real thing. I mean, for example, you can go up to Ano Nuevo today and you can lean over the boardwalk that they've put there and you can watch the interaction of the elephant seal moms with their babies up close and personal. It's like the Serengeti right here in America. You don't have to go to any other park, but you can go to one and hold that memory inside you.
That's true. That's so true. By the way, I want to tell our listeners that we are recording this in my home, and here we are talking about nature, and my cat Yoda has been walking in and out, and he's a very vocal cat. So if you hear a meow here and there, no, not the little kitten sleeping on the chair, but Yoda, the gray one over across the room, now he's munching on the food. Anyway, he puts in his 2 cents every once in a while, but this is a nature show, so it's perfectly okay.
We can handle dogs, cats, birds, even the bobcat I think I saw in the middle of the night run across our property last night.
Last night? Really?
Yeah. David and I are recent homeowners here in Calaveras, beautiful Calaveras County. We discovered it, actually, is it okay if I go into
the
house?
Oh, please do, yeah.
We discovered it by making this film. Some of the process of the making this film is interesting. David and I, as a couple, scouted every single park that we envisioned filming in, just the two of us, before we brought our film crew in. We visited nearly 100 parks to do so. We ended up filming in close to 47 parks, but we visited 100 parks. And because we knew we were going to have this great opportunity to see some of the most beautiful and hidden gems of our state, we thought, maybe we should use this time to plant a seed in ourselves of where we might like to live, as we call it, our Chapter 3. Where do we want to be? Do we want to be in Los Angeles the rest of our lives? And we did not think about it as an assignment so much as it was in the back of our minds. And when we were filming up in Big Trees, Calaveras,
which is just 26 miles up the road from this house,
26 miles up the road from this house, and 5 miles up the road from the house that we purchased in Arnold.
Oh my gosh, really?
We looked at each other and we said, this place speaks to me. Does it speak to you? And, of course, I, being a little more urban, said, but is there a good restaurant?
And there are. There are good restaurants here and there.
Here and there. And it was discovering Murphy's 10 minutes down the road that led me to believe I think we could do this because there are a few good restaurants.
And then there's Camps here.
And
a couple of really good ones downtown, Crusco's and Sidewinder's. There's the Mercantile that sells wonderful ice cream. You've got to have their ice cream and their hot chocolate in the wintertime.
And every time I come home to our beautiful home up above Arnold, I am going to reverberate something we've said a lot. Just knowing that Big Trees, those big, grand, fabulous, soulful trees are up the street from me, sometimes means that I don't visit it every single time, but I should.
That's right. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. We are talking with Sally Kaplan about her documentary that she made with her husband, David Vassar. It's called California Forever. Now, Sally, this documentary, of course, is big and paramount in your life right now, but you've done others. And there was one about the Grand Tetons you wanted to talk about a little bit.
Yes. David and our company, Backcountry Pictures, is on the map a little bit with visitor centers for national parks as well as state parks. And we were invited to bid on a project when Grand Teton National Park was in the process of planning a new visitor center, which they needed badly. And as we're not commissioned artists per se, but we often get requests for proposals, and when this one came to my attention, we were actually in the Grand Teton at the time at a film festival called the, I'm forgetting the name, but it's the Jackson Hole Wildlife Film Festival that we go to
every
other year.
They have some big things there. I have never been, but it sounds wonderful.
It's wonderful. It's where people from across the world who are working in natural history films come together with ideas and contests and share each other's work and whatnot. And I received this package in the mail, and it was from the Grand Teton Natural History Association inviting us to bid on a project, and they wanted us to turn in the proposal in 3 days. Well, David Vassar's reaction is, we don't have the time, we're not going to do it. Well, I read carefully what they were asking, and the dancer in me, the choreographer in me, said, we must do it. Because what they wanted us to do as filmmakers was not make a sit-down, look-at-the-wall, proscenium stage film. They wanted us to make a film that was going to appear as a piece of an installation in the floor. The projections were in the basement looking up, and as you walk into the visitor center space, and you see things on the wall like you would in any visitor center, you are then drawn to some light and sound that occurs in the floor. And these images that we choreographed, essentially, walk the viewer through to the next.
Oh, it sounds fabulous. Wow. When did you do this?
We did that also. It was the same year that we were finishing up the Hetch Hetchy film. So it was 2007, 2008. And it does still exist in the Grand Teton Visitor Center.
Oh, my goodness. I hope it's there a long time. I've been at the Grand Tetons, but before you did this. So I'm going to have to go back there and see it again.
And it was interesting. The reason why I wanted to bring it up is not so much to let people know the other kind of works we've done before California Forever, but it's been interesting as a creative person to have to shape and approach each given project that we take on in its appropriate way. The Grand Teton project, we were much freer to be very abstract in our imagery. In fact, the assignment from Ralph Applebaum group that did the interior exhibit design, they've also done the Holocaust Museum, I believe, in Washington, D.C.
Oh, okay.
They said, what we'd like you to do, believe it or not, is focus on anything but the iconic images. Mm-hmm. Because there are other places in the visitor center and the surroundings that give audience members that. We want you to give them images of places they might not see. The moose and her baby walking by, for example, which we happened upon. It was not something we were able to stage at all.
Oh my God.
The ice and the 20 below zero winters that occurs there in the streams that no one goes because no one would dare be outside other than a film crew at that time.
Wow, must have been kind of uncomfortable now and then, but certainly very, yeah, she's grimacing. She's making a face. But yeah, what an experience. So you got to go and actually be there for how long? Over a period of a couple of years?
We actually shot that in 1 year. We made sure to cover each season, which was important. I think the development of the film was a couple months before that, but we shot it in a 1 year time. But what's interesting is for this film, we had to wrap our heads around a very different style of storytelling. We could be abstract, perhaps, in the collaborative way David always is with our cinematographer, Chris Tufte, because they've worked together for over 35 years.
Mm.
They used to work together in the film department at the Smithsonian. But they could be abstract perhaps in the way they set up an image. But in episode one, which is the history of California State Parks, we had to be really accurate about our facts. I mean, I researched that film heavily to give the information to David for him to write the script. But Linda, you talked to me about this in the break a little bit too, that you're approaching a book now, and tell me, how is it different from some of the other things that you write?
Oh, yes. Well, I just recently was hired by the Calaveras Enterprise to write a health column once a week. It's in every Friday, and you can actually go and read it at calaverasenterprise.com. I've written about shingles. I've written about heart disease, diseases of the eye. And you have to, as you said, when you're researching something, you have to be so factual and so accurate. I do not want to make a mistake. It's so different from writing a novel, although my novel is set in the Civil War, and so I do have to be very accurate about that, too. And I showed you my shelf full of books on the Civil War that I'm reading, which is why I never get to write on the book. But, yeah, it's totally different. And, of course, you mentioned poetry. If someone is writing poetry, they have to be so concise and so precise, and they have to look for words that have layers of meaning. So there are so many different approaches to writing, and such. It's a fabulous mental exercise to take different approaches and see where they lead you. They uncover hidden talents that you didn't know that you had, hopefully. I mean, in my case, hopefully.
And in the making of this film, the research that we had to do led to the script, and the script left room for our interviewees not knowing exactly what they were going to say at any given time. I mean, the final script took into account what they said following the interview. But so we left a lot of the historic facts up to the experts that we chose to interview for episode one. But no film like this is made solo. I mean, people often say, how did you and David do this by yourself? Well, in fact, we did not do it by ourselves. I mean, we had a advisory team of historians and interpretive parks people and people who had retired from working on the parks and people who are still working in the parks. We did not do it alone. No film is made solo.
Yeah. So how many people were involved with helping you on this film, and what were their jobs? I know David was the writer and the director, and you were the producer, but you said that those roles overlapped quite a bit as you were progressing. But who else did you have?
Well, we have a crew that we've worked closely with over the years. There were about, I'd say, five was the core group that included myself and David, our cinematographer, an assistant to the cinematographer, a lighting person and a sound person, and a production assistant or two, or in some cases three or four or five, depending how many pieces of large equipment had to be carried far from the car into the woods.
Oh.
But then there were certain segments of the program that we did that included up to 15 or 20 people, and that's when we did reenactments with actors, and we had to have appropriate costume attire. So we had a wardrobe person, and then we had a makeup person to make them look beautiful, and then we had a props person to make sure that the 19th century, the camera that the character was using was accurate and appropriate to the time. Or the gun shooter. We found a gentleman from Sonora who's actually a gun smoke shooter. He shoots guns and does reenactments as a hobby in his life. And he showed up. We hired a art director and a wardrobe person to make sure that he had all the proper paraphernalia, and none of it was needed because he showed up with everything that he needed.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
And then for that case, we had to have a member of the Calaveras Arnold Fire Department with us because he was shooting, and there had to be someone with us so that we could get the proper permitting in case the ashes left behind would start a fire. Mm-hmm. So there are numerous people that have to come into the making of a film. Another shoot that was memorable for me as a producer was we shot at the California Railroad Museum, which is a wonderful historic place.
Oh, isn't that wonderful? Yes, it's just fabulous.
fabulous. And we had a large crew that night, and we had to shoot all night long because the museum is open, and we could not start when the public were there. So, and we had a crane, about a 24-foot crane, I believe, which is something that you see often outside, you know, in a construction site, but we had to bring it inside. It's a triple ceiling high.
Yes, a very high ceiling.
High space we put it in, and we had extras that were lined up to appear in the scene. And of course, it was the middle of the night, so none of them showed up. So we had to have people go outside and collect people as they were walking by in the middle of the night to participate. And now you're getting an idea of what I did as a producer.
Let me think now. Middle of the night in downtown Sacramento, who would be walking by?
Interesting group.
Interesting characters, yes. Oh, my goodness, I never realized it was so much fun and so varied to make a film. What an experience. Darn, we're out of time again, Sally.
No!
Part three is over. Stay tuned for part four.
How did that happen so fast?
Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. We are talking about the documentary California Forever. It's going to be on PBS probably tonight, so listen and watch. And the producer, who is my guest, is Sally Kaplan. She did this documentary with her husband, David Vassar. Sally, you said that you and David went to almost 100 parks as you did this, and you saw so much that we all have seen. I haven't seen 100 parks, but there are places that are familiar to all of us, but you, I bet you, saw a lot of things that we have not seen.
Yes, we did. If I look back and say what stood out to me most in the visiting these parks and the creating a film about some of these parks, interestingly, what stands out are not necessarily the iconic places, not necessarily the places that we all think of when we think of California's rugged coast or California's Grand Mountain. What stands out to me are some of the lesser known places. They might not be lesser known to the people who frequent them, but for example, I did not know they were necessarily parks, and that's something that stood out to me as a producer in the creation of this film again and again. What exactly is a park? What makes it a park? What makes someone want to preserve a special place? What makes it special to them and want to preserve it as a state park? They're places you would not normally think of. Old Town San Diego is a state park.
Oh, that's right, and it's fabulous, and I don't think of it as a state park.
No, nor do many, and it is, in fact, this is a fact, the most visited state park in the state of California. Another one that stands out to me is a pretty new park. It's called Baldwin Hills Overlook, and it's featured in the film in episode 2. And what stood out to me about Baldwin Hills Scenic Overlook in Los Angeles is not its breathtaking beauty, because I had been to plenty of other more breathtakingly beautiful places. What stood out to me is how it's used in the community. I mean, this is a park that is on the border of Culver City and Englewood. It's largely African-American and Latino community. And they were saying, you know, we want more green. We don't want you to just build anything here. And people gathered together and preserved this place as a park. And there's a local high school down the street called Dorsey High, which in the past has had a high rate of dropouts and difficult problems, gangs and whatnot. And there's a program there at Dorsey High that takes students into Baldwin Hills Scenic Overlook, whereby they restore the plants, they plant native plants, and they are becoming not only the next generation of natural resource workers, but they're going to college and becoming the next generation of political science majors and whatnot. I was extremely inspired by these young people in this particular park.
How wonderful. That shows how exposure to nature can really heal some people.
That's really well put. I mean, there's a whole theory out there called nature deficit disorder, which I'm forgetting the name of the gentleman, Louvre is his name. He wrote an entire book about it, whereby children these days who don't have easy access to parks and sometimes simply might have a park down the street, but their parents don't feel safe letting them go run and play spud by themselves in the park. And they're so hooked onto their iPods and their iPhones and their Twitter computer and their computers that the natural exercise I got when I was a kid doesn't exist unless you give them green and give them access in their own communities. And that was a real eye-opener for me in the working on this piece. As David likes to point out frequently, this is the population in California when there's a ballot measure available for Californians to vote for parks. This is the population that overwhelmingly votes for parks, but doesn't often get to go to the very places that their tax dollars are paying for. So the idea of building places in their own backyard where they do have access and creating them as state parks is more important than ever.
Oh, yes, that's true. I just heard on the radio the other day about a heavily populated region near Washington, D.C. There's a bridge over the Anacostia River that they are taking out of service for automobiles and trucks, and they are turning the bridge into a park, and it will be a place for people to go and walk, and there will be greenery planted there, and there will be activities, a place for people to get into nature. And thank you for sharing this term that I had never heard before, nature deficit disorder. I think we're going to hear more and more about that in the future. So what are some of the places then that really stick out in your mind that we will see in part two of the documentary?
There's a very, very touching story that always makes me tear up when I watch it today in part two. And Angel Island is a lovely setting outside of San Francisco where people take a boat ride, ferry ride, and they get to bike around, and they get to experience nature, and they get to picnic and enjoy the views. But there's a rather undertold story that takes place on Angel Island also, which we researched and highlighted as a segment in our film. And it's the Angel Island Immigration Station, which now is a California state park. And during the Chinese Exclusion Act, and forgetting the years that occurred, when many immigrants were coming to the States and many were coming through Angel Island the way they did when they came through Ellis Island on the New York side, were Asian. And Asians and largely Chinese for a period of time were in fact detained there. They were more or less imprisoned there. They were grilled questions that were not always easy to answer, sometimes unanswerable questions. And if they didn't get them right, they were detained longer or sent back to China. And this is a place that commemorates the collective memory of this group of people that many people don't know. I certainly did not know it until I worked on this film. Similarly, with a more happy footnote, is a place in the Central Valley of California, not far from Bakersfield, called Colonel Allensworth State Park. And there was a period in American history when utopia societies were an area that many peoples were exploring, and often in California. And this was a society that was created by freed slaves to prove that they, on their own, could farm and could be self-sufficient and could teach their children. And to this day, it's been preserved as a state park. So these two stand out to me not only as touching stories, but as symbolic stories of where parks in the future probably are going to have to go, because people in California are so diverse. Different peoples are going to want a place that commemorates their memory, not that only people from that group would go to visit these places, but that they can have a place that speaks to something that maybe people never would have known otherwise.
That's true. That's true. That's, so the whole concept is probably going to develop and morph into something else. How wonderful. Sally, we're just about out of time. I can't believe it. We've got to remind the people the program is on PBS, and you go ahead and tell what you want to tell.
The show is going to air on PBS throughout California and throughout the nation. You can find your local listings by going to our website. It's called California.com. It is spelled C-A-L, the number 4, ever.com. And it will be playing on KBIE in the Sacramento and Calaveras and Sonora area. And we look forward to you tuning in and enjoying these places.
Right. That's calforever.com. C-A-L, the number 4, E-V-E-R.com. You'll see their website. You'll get to see a little preview of the films.
If they click on PBS.
Click on PBS. You'll get the schedule. Get the schedules in your area. And Sally, I want to thank you so much for coming today and sharing all this wonderful information with us. And I hope that we have motivated everybody to just be glued to their TV sets to see this program.
Thank you so much, Linda. It's been much more fun than I ever would have imagined talking to you.
Well, there was Yoda to help us, too, with his little meowing. Okay, everybody. Well, thank you for listening. Please send me an email. Let me know if you heard the show and how you liked it. Give me suggestions for future shows. Send me something for morning workout. Come on, I want to read your poetry. I want to read your flash fiction. Send me something. You might get to hear your work on the air. Isn't that worth something? Come on, get on, get busy. Come back and see me again next Sunday morning. Until then, have a great week.
You've been listening to Manzanita Voices, a production of the Manzanita Writers Press, an affiliate of the Calaveras County Arts Council.